This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Donald Trump has pulled America out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, and this has some people hyperventilating about how he is dooming the planet to extinction. Well, they might not be quite so dramatic about it, but they do talk about that agreement and other such efforts to reduce humankind's impact on the climate as if this is absolutely necessary for our planet's survival. But they're making some major assumptions, and we're going to talk with environmental biologist Andrew Miller about some of those assumptions. We'll have a very interesting discussion about just how much scientific or how little scientific consensus there actually is about man-made climate change. North Korea is one of the most repressive regimes in the world, and it's been making some serious threats against the United States lately. Why is it that this little nation is so strongly and virulently anti-American? A recent Washington Post article said, well, at least part of the blame lies with the United States and the way that we conducted ourselves in the Korean War. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Abraham Blondeau about the history of the Korean War and why the Washington Post is wrong. North Korea, these ballistic missiles that it has been firing, this is a country with a nuclear capability. This has brought the subject of nuclear war back into the headlines. We've seen a number of nuclear tests in recent decades, not only from unpredictable North Korea, but even a nation like unstable Pakistan. The Islamic Republic of Iran continues to develop nuclear weapons and missiles to deliver them. We've also learned how many former Soviet states have lax security, nuclear capability, and they're not taking care to make sure that those armaments are secure. Even sites in America and Europe are vulnerable to theft. Well, what happens if those weapons get into the wrong hands? These are really important questions in this age of terrorism. In our third segment, we're going to talk with Trumpet writer Brad McDonald about what it's like to experience a nuclear attack. He wrote an article about this a couple of years back, about the people who experienced the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in World War II. This interview is from the archives, but I think it's quite relevant to us today, and it's an important subject for us to wrap our imaginations around. And I'll finish the program today with a poem from one of our listeners. We had a segment a couple of weeks back talking about the importance of good posture. And this is a listener who said that it has been quite a trial to try to implement that instruction. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Last week, U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew America from the Paris Climate Change Agreement. There are commentators who are acting like this is going to plunge the world into a future of climatic disasters. Now, in order to believe that, you have to have a whole lot of assumptions, and there's plenty of evidence showing that there are some pretty shaky assumptions. To talk about this, we have an environmental biologist, Andrew Miller, who is also a Trumpet writer. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
So the people behind the Paris climate deal, they basically say that there is virtually unanimous understanding in the scientific community that agreements like this one are absolutely necessary in order to protect the future of our planet. And I just want to talk about some of the ways that is actually incorrect. First of all, just how much scientific unanimity is there about this subject?
Well, definitely not as much as you'd think. Probably a lot of our listeners have heard the 97% figure. Former President Barack Obama, you had mentioned it several times during his presidencies, that 97% of scientists believe that man-made global warming is real and dangerous, which is a pretty gross misrepresentations of the facts. That 97% figure is based off a study that was done of 12,000 peer-related journal articles in Australia. But when you actually look at the study, it says that 97% of climate scientists who take a dogmatic position on global warming believe that man-made climate change is real. And so when you actually look at the number of those 12,000, two-thirds of those journal articles said there's not enough evidence to make a proclamation either way.
Wow.
Then
so
roughly,
it was the one-third that said we can make a proclamation.
So amongst the one-third that said that you can dogmatically proclaim what's happening, 3% said man-made global warming is not happening, and 97% said man-made global warming is happening. But it totally leaves out the fact that two-thirds of scientists say that there's no proof to make either claim.
Well, yeah, so that's that's to say that that statistically misrepresents the facts is a little bit of an understatement.
Right, so it's only 33% of climate scientists that say man-made global warming is happening. And even that figure, I mean, it got to be, I'm sure a lot of these people are well-meaning, but it is also an undeniable fact that the federal government in the United States has given out $35 billion in climate change funding since 1989, and many key academics, Thomas Sowell among them, has really pointed out that amongst climate change scientists, if you'd like to get some grants or a piece of that funding, it's really hard to get any of it if your research is trying to make the claim that man-made global warming isn't happening. Because just basic human nature, I mean, if man-made global warming is a threat to the planet, that means we have to do whatever we can to stop it, which means that we need government regulation of the economy. So there's definitely a vested interest, if you're a government bureaucrat, why you'd give a scientist money if his research is saying that government bureaucrats need more power to stop ecological apocalypse.
Okay, so you covered a lot of ground there, and I'd like to, maybe we can kind of parcel this out here over the next few questions. Going back to just the question of unanimity, there are questions related to what is actually happening with the climate. It seems that the scientific community has gone from saying that the world is cooling to saying that it's warming to saying that it's entering a period of chaos. Looking at the data scientifically, how can we make sense of what's actually happening with the climate?
It is fairly unanimous that, I mean, there is some debate, but most scientists will admit that the climate has warmed approximately 1 degree Fahrenheit in the past 100 years, but it has not been a uniform warmer. Actually, surprisingly, most of that warming occurred during the first half of the 20th century, between 1900 and 1950, when carbon emissions were not nearly as high as they are today.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, during the 70s, the temperature was actually going down a little bit, causing Newsweek and Time Magazine and a bunch of other well-known Western media outlets to proclaim a new ice age was coming and global cooling was coming.
Mm-hmm.
Then the temperature started to go up for a couple decades, causing scientists to say, well, now global warming's the threat. And since the mid-90s, temperatures have pretty well stabilized, saying that now they usually use the term climate change because the temperature isn't actually cooling or warming for the past 10 years. But if you take the broad look over a century, they generally agree that temperatures have gone up 1 degree.
So if you look at that century in the context of a longer period and just what we understand about climate on the Earth over, say, a period of millennia or even longer, how does that how unusual is it for the temperature to change for a degree over a period of 100 years?
What we know, extrapolating from like tree ring size, obviously trees grow faster when the climate's warmer. They grow slower when the climate's colder. Ice core data, it snows more in certain climatic conditions, like lake sediments. In the past 6,000 years, climate has varied from 2 degrees colder than what it is right now to 2 degrees warmer than what it is right now. So this 1%, this one degree change we've seen over the last century is well within the Earth's natural climatic variation. It's actually, when you look at these tree ring data and these ice core data, it's actually a fairly predictable cycle of about 1,000 years heating and cooling. They said like 6,000 years ago, it's estimated that temperatures were probably 2 to 3 degrees hotter than they are right now. If you're trying to compare that with like biblical history, that would have been like around the time Noah was alive, things were much warmer than they are right now. Then you kind of had a miniature ice age around like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob's time. And then it got warm again, close to current temperatures, like during the reigns of King David and Solomon. Scientists call the Minoan warm period, because the Minoan civilization was also prominent during that time. Cooled down for a couple hundred years. Then it was also, there was a time period of warming during the Roman warm period, miniature ice age during the Dark Ages, the medieval warm period. That's one you probably would be most likely to have heard of. This is when the Vikings were exploring Greenland, and when even contemporary historical records have about like the grape harvest and parts of England that don't grow grapes today. Another cooler period around the time of the American Revolution. And then this would be the, at least from the past 6,000 years, we'd be right in the midst of the Earth's fifth warm period right now.
So it seems the narrative that the scientists, or say that the governments of the world and the Paris Climate Change Agreement folks want to promote is that it is man-made global climate change. It is human endeavors today that are creating carbon emissions and these types of things. This is the cause for this this chaos that we're seeing. But you're talking about fluctuations that happen over a period of thousands of years. What sort of evidence are they looking at to link human activity with changes in the climate?
Well, the main thing that when they try to say that is they say that obviously due to the burning of coal and oil and fossil fuels, there's carbon molecules in those fossil fuels that are released as carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And so they're trying to say that as the carbon dioxide increases in the atmosphere, that forms like a blanket around the planet that keeps the heat in, which is a scientific principle that you'd see on planets like Venus, where you have hundreds of times the carbon dioxide level you have on Earth. It is much warmer because of that. Here on Earth, though, British journalist Melanie Phillips points out, the correlation isn't as neat as they're trying to point it, as they're saying that, okay, well, as the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere go up, the temperature goes up. But it doesn't always work that way, because obviously for carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere have been going up for the past 2 decades, but temperatures have been stalled. There have been times when carbon dioxide levels actually have gone down and temperatures gone up. If you're looking at ice core data, there were times of when carbon dioxide levels were higher than they are now, and there was an ice age.
Huh.
So it's the correlation between, and even pointing out that there are times when temperatures go up and then carbon dioxide levels go up afterwards instead of before, like you'd think. It is also known that ocean water emits some carbon dioxide when it warms up. So if you're talking about natural heating cycles, if the Earth was getting warmer due to solar activity or some other natural cause, that could also cause the oceans to emit more carbon dioxide later instead of being the other way around, like the general political consensus is that, well, man emits carbon dioxide and then the temperature goes up.
Right. So how strong is the evidence? I mean, is it all just basically manufactured evidence suggesting that, well, because we're driving the wrong kinds of cars and because we're burning coal and these types of things, that's the reason why carbon emissions are increasing and therefore the climate is changing.
Right. Well, and like I said, that is, I myself would probably fall into the category of those two-thirds of scientists who just say that it's really hard to say evidence either way, because it is known that the planet is roughly 1 degree warmer than it was a century ago. Carbon dioxide levels do happen to be, at least as far as they can tell, and there's some controversy over their measurement techniques, a little higher right now. But that correlation hasn't always held true over history. So it is kind of one of those things that there is definitely a school of thought that it's solar activity. You can like track sunspots that the sun itself goes through cycles where it's a little hotter and a little colder. And that if the sun's warmer and that heats up the earth, that causes the oceans to emit some carbon dioxide. And so they come up the other way. So right now it would be hard for me to say how much of the data about high carbon dioxide is manufactured, because there does look to be some compelling evidence that carbon dioxide may be higher than it was 100 years ago, same as temperatures higher than 100 years ago. But to say that's due to man-made industrial activity, there's not enough evidence to say either way.
So you were talking earlier about just the research dollars and how they basically tend to get funneled toward those scientists who are basically proving a pre-existing idea, and those who are producing research that tends to go counter to the received wisdom don't get that money. And so that accounts for a fair amount of the disparity between those studies that supposedly underline this theory and those that run counter to it.
Right. Well, that is definitely... You'll hear now and again people talk about like the oil industry financing anti-global warming research, and there's probably been a couple billion dollars given to climate change research by energy companies, but that pales in significance to the $35 billion that the government has been giving scientists that are producing research that verifies that the solution that man-made global warming is happening is, and the solution is give the government more power.
Right. So this is really maybe gives us an indication of what some of the underlying reasons for why these governments are moving down this path and they're pushing this so hard is at the end of the day, it means they have more power. They're able to regulate people more. They can basically create winners and losers among a free market economy to shape it the way that they want to.
Right. And of course, the United States, we don't necessarily have a Green Party, but in Europe, most nations have their own Green Party. That's their pro-environmental party. And almost to the last one, they're all socialist parties. And you look at their platform, I mean, a lot of the more radical ones will even say that like free market capitalism and an environmentally friendly earth cannot coexist. And so it is kind of one of those things that, especially if you push it to the apocalyptic levels that a lot of these, I mean, if you're trying to make the case that man-made global carbon dioxide emissions are enhancing the natural heating and cooling of the earth by a degree or so, that's not a huge existential crisis. Not enough to, even if that's true, it wouldn't be enough to like throw away democracy and free market capitalism to stop the planet from getting 1 degree warmer.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can exaggerate the research to the point where like, well, the planet's going to get 4, 5, 10 degrees warmer, ocean levels are going to rise 20 feet, Washington, D.C. and the state of Florida are going to be underwater unless you surrender your ability to run your own business to a government bureaucrat who knows better than you do what type of emissions and what you can be burning and what you can be manufacturing. That would be... really a dream for anyone who likes a central planned economy. Mm-hmm. Saying that, well, whether you like socialism or not, you have to do this. Otherwise, you're all going to burn up and drown.
Right. Well, a fascinating subject. There's a lot of different angles to it and facets to it, and we'd like to include some of that and write some of that up in the Trumpet coming up. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about some of the evidence undermining the idea that climate change is directly caused by human endeavors, certainly on the scale that that the people who are promoting the Paris Climate Change Agreement and so on would have you believe. But Andrew is working on an article about this, and hopefully we can get this into an upcoming edition of the Trumpet print edition. You can keep your eye on thetrumpet.com for that. Andrew, we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The Korean Peninsula is a very tense place right now. North Korea is one of the most repressive and authoritarian regimes in the world. It's very unpredictable. It's been firing a lot of missiles lately and making direct threats against the United States. The regime of Kim Jong-un is extremely anti-American. And why is that? Well, a recent Washington Post article said we can pin part of the blame, at least, on the United States itself and the way that we conducted ourselves in the Korean War. Trumpet writer and resident history buff Abraham Blondeau says that is not the case. The Washington Post has it all wrong. He's here in the studio to recall for us some of this important history. Hello, Abraham.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's good to have you. So talk about this Washington Post analysis, first of all. What is their view? Why is it that they think that America is to blame for the anti-Americanism in North Korea?
Sure. So the perspective they take on it is that the North Korea, they have propaganda. They teach your children that Americans are wolves and that they're predators and that they're evil imperialistic people. And the way they prove it is by using history from the Korean War, that America was attacking North Korea. And so and that's part of where that hatred comes from, at least in their narrative. And so the Washington Post says, well, there's a small kernel of truth in that because we did kill a lot of North Korean civilians. It was a very brutal war between both sides. And so America has a little bit of blame for why North Korea hates us. And I believe that's just ridiculous. But the main proof they use is the air campaign where we dropped more bombs on North Korea in the 3 years than we did in the entire Pacific theater during World War II. So they use that. And then just some quotes from historians who say that the struggle between the two nations created this bitterness that North Korea still resent us for today. And so it is interesting take, and they do bring up some good points, but I think they reached the wrong conclusion, and that is North Korea started the war, and also that everything America did was retaliatory and was done out of survival. It wasn't done because out of hatred or anything like that. And so the idea that America should apologize or feel shameful for what we did in North Korea is crazy, because it was a just war. And if anything, we should have used more force to end the regime, the communist regime there.
And this coming from a Canadian. So,
yes. Yeah.
So obviously, let's go ahead and I'd like to talk more about just the, say, proportionality of America's response to what North Korea was doing, and specifically with respect to the air campaign. Maybe we could just back up a little bit, and you look at the situation in North Korea. You know, this very repressive regime in the North, this democracy in the South. How did we end up there, and why is that relevant to the question of what America did in the Korean War?
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question. And just to give a brief overview of the conflict, because the origins are very important, and that is Japan occupied Korea during World War II. And so when Japan surrendered, America and the Soviet Union decided to split it in two. Have some kind of agreement like in Berlin and Germany, where it was split into different occupying forces. And so during that time, and then they were going to unite the two sides eventually. But in that time, Stalin had Kim Il-sung as leader of the North, America had Syngman Rhee.
So Russia was responsible for the North Korean leader. They basically put him into power there.
Yes, sir. Yeah, the Soviet leadership did put the Kim dynasty in place. They're the ones who made him leader of North Korea. And so the 38th parallel, the current border, that was just made as a rough middle ground between the two sides. And so after World War II, no one expected the Cold War to happen. But as Stalin was more and more unwilling to cooperate with America, Korea became an example of where you had communist aggression starting to boil over. And so one thing that she points out here, or the author in the Washington Post points out, is that Kim Il-sung wanted to unite Korea, and that's true. But it had a lot to do with Joseph Stalin. Stalin either ordered it or he encouraged Kim Il-sung to attack in the first place. So the Korean War has to be viewed in the context of the Soviet Union, of Joseph Stalin using it as a test of American will. But basically, for 5 years, America had been demobilizing. So when North Korea attacked, they overwhelmed the Americans and the South Koreans, pushed them to Busan in the south, basically overran the entire peninsula until MacArthur came from Japan. Incheon, he surrounded the North Koreans, pushed them back to the 38th parallel. And then he attacked north, but he went too close to the Yalu River, which is the border of North Korea and China. Mm-hmm. And then China attacked and pushed America back to the 38th parallel. And that's where the current border is, and that's how basically the war ended, was along those lines roughly. But what's interesting is that it was American response was to aggression from the communist side. That mm-hmm. that's a very clear fact of history. And then Americans' response was actually limited. Although 4/5 of America's Air Force was being used in Korea, President Truman created the Truman Doctrine from the Korean War. And that is, we don't have to defeat communism by invading them. We just need to contain them. And so Korea is the current circumstances we have today of a North Korean regime and South Korea being a democratic country is caused by the deliberate policy of the United States to contain North Korea and not conquer them. And so that's where there's a lot of controversy with Douglas MacArthur, because he viewed that differently than President Truman did at the time.
So, and that maybe that's a question that we could return to if we have time later on. Just the fact that the problems that we see with Korea today really do trace right back to the way that the situation was handled back in the times of the Korean War. Let's go back now and talk about, say, the air campaign. And this is really a point that the Washington Post criticizes the United States pretty heavily and says it was disproportionate. It was because the bombing was so extreme. This is sort of what engendered this hostility of the North against the United States. Put that in context for us.
Sure. Yeah. If you do look at it just statistically through that narrow lens, it can look disproportionate because North Korea didn't really have an air force. What they did have was provided by the Soviet Union. They sent planes and pilots to help fight off the Americans. And so if you look at it, the United States dropped 635,000 tons of bombs in Korea, which is about 130,000 more than the Pacific Theater in World War II, so a huge amount. Basically, all of North Korea was leveled. Most of the major cities were leveled. All the important industrial complexes were.
Which there wouldn't have been a whole lot of that.
Correct. Yeah, North Korea is a very low technology country. And so the Washington Post says America bombed North Korea so much they ran out of targets. That's true, but that's because there weren't that many in the first place, because North Korea didn't have a lot of industry. And so the reason why there were a lot of civilian casualties, much like the same policy the Allies had against Germany, was that during World War II, is that they wanted to break the will of the communist people in North Korea, but also a lot of civilians amassed around military targets. You had a lot of refugees, a lot of people right near military targets, and so they became unfortunate victims of American air power.
And how much of that was actually by design?
Very little. When the American Bomber Command were bombing cities and places close to civilian places, they did accept there'd be some casualties. but under no circumstances were there any deliberate attempts to kill just civilian population.
Well, what I mean is, how much of it was the design of the North in terms of putting civilians in peril, or say positioning targets, military targets, close to civilians in order to, I guess, make it less palatable for the United States to target those areas?
Well, yeah, that's a great point you bring up, because there was a lot of deception that way, in which the North Koreans would use civilians to fight against American troops, or they would wear civilian clothing, and so they can try to get behind American lines and then start causing havoc. And so for American fighter pilots who made low strafing runs on columns in North Korea and American troops, they had a very difficult time telling who was enemy and who was friendly, mm-hmm. Who was a civilian, because they dressed like civilians, and a lot of the North Korean army told their civilians to go and kill American soldiers. And so it made a very difficult choice. Do you sacrifice the life of your fellow soldiers just because you're afraid to kill someone who you don't really know is an enemy or not? And so a lot of the civilian casualties are caused by North Korea using their people to deceive Americans, or by basically using them as cannon fodder to go take down American troops instead of their own soldiers.
Looking at the Korean War, a lot of historians just talk about the brutality of that war, and it was really uniquely brutal in a lot of ways. What is the cause of that? If there are people who want to pin the blame on the United States for perpetrating that brutality, what would your answer to that be?
Well, the answer is that it's that brutality stems from the way the communist armies were fighting. And there's a lot of one book I quote in particular in the article called American Soldiers by Peter Kinsvater, documents the brutalities that the North Koreans and the Chinese did against American troops, especially the North Koreans. They would execute prisoners, mutilate bodies, lots of terrible things. Did that to civilians too. And so the American troops, they did have a lot of brutal fighting, and they did kill. There was a no-prisoner policy, basically.
A no-prisoner. The United States would not take prisoners, though.
Correct. Yeah, in a very informal way, just because a lot of Chinese and North Korean troops would try to kill Americans if they tried to give them medical aid. They would pull grenade pins, and they didn't want to risk more lives by that. And the North Koreans and Chinese fought with such disregard of life, disregard of their own lives, but also the lives of anyone else, that it did harden the American troops against them, because they this the hand-to-hand combat, this the intense experience, made the Americans realize that they had to fight to the death, because they didn't want to be captured. They didn't want their friends to be captured and mutilated. And so it created this really bitter antagonism of the American troops against their enemies because of how they were treated.
The United States forces actually were very adamant not wanting to be captured by communist forces because of the treatment that those who were captured received.
Yes, yeah. They a lot of them realized it's better to fight to the death than to be captured. And those who were captured, they especially early on in the war, they were treated more poorly. At the end, the Chinese and North Koreans would try to convert them to communism. Because that's their doctrine that Mao had, that communism is superior, so the soldiers should probably want to come over to our side. So just a lot of strange indoctrination tactics. Some of them are absurd, but a handful of American and British soldiers did convert to communism while they were in captivity. So just a lot of that was more towards the end of the war. But basically, all the bitterness, the scale of combat was caused by the communist forces, their disregard for life and their policy of basically annihilation. They want to destroy the enemy. And so the lack of clemency and mercy showed by the communists towards the Americans, the Canadians, and the British troops who also fought in Korea had to be responded to in kind. For out of survival, just the troops had to fight with that level of ferocity just to survive the combat. And so that's not really addressed in the Washington Post piece, but that's important to realizing the nature of the North Korean regime, is that's the kind of barbarity they try to indoctrinate their people with.
So the Washington Post is looking back at this history and drawing the moral lesson that, well, the United States just needs to conduct its war-making activities with greater circumspection, that we need to be more careful in the way that we treat our enemies. Otherwise, we're going to engender this kind of irrational anti-Americanism that we see in the North Korean regime today. You take very different lessons from it, I presume. I just wonder, when you look at this history, what sort of lessons do you think we can take from it?
Well, I think the big lesson to take away, the main one, and a lot of people are starting to realize this more, is that North Korea exists because we did not stop it, that we allowed it to exist. And if America should apologize for anything from the Korean War, it's that we allowed Kim Il-sung to continue ruling, and that we did not stand up to China in the winter of 1950 like we could have. And we have the benefit of hindsight. Look at now, North Korea has nuclear weapons. They're becoming a major threat to the security of the world. And all that's only possible because America decided to have a limited response. And President Truman and after MacArthur was fired, General Ridgway, who was in command, they decided that policy because it would be very costly in terms of men and money. But also they knew the American people didn't have the willpower to support another offensive against the communists. And so I think the great lesson from the Korean War is that limited war does not pay off. It just leads to more problems in the future. But also it reflected the lack of will, and was kind of a reflection on how far America fell in those 5 years since World War II ended. That we went from being a superpower that ended Nazi Germany, we took down Japan. There was just a lot of strength there to where we can't even overcome little North Korea. And they had a sizable Chinese army with them, mm-hmm. Supporting them. But still, there wasn't that same resolve that was there just 5 years before. And it did show a big moral decline that Herbert Armstrong talked a lot about at the time. And he said in 1961, in A Plain Truth, that America has won their last war, talking about World War II, and how I think it's interesting that Korea is called a forgotten war in American history. But the reason we lost, and the reason we have all these problems, is because we forgot God. And that's why the Korean War was so tragic, why it was mediocre in some ways. We didn't achieve a final victory. We just we settled for a ceasefire, for an armistice that's still there today. And why we allowed the demented dictatorship of the Kims to exist to this day. Just we lacked the will to pursue victory.
Very interesting. We've been talking with trumpet writer Abraham Blondeau about the Korean War and lessons that we can take from that. He's written an article that's up on thetrumpet.com called The Washington Post Gets the Korean War All Wrong, criticizing some of the conclusions that the Washington Post author made about the Korean War and why we're facing the problems with North Korea today. We appreciate your looking into that. It's a really excellent article, a lengthy analysis piece. Go read that on thetrumpet.com. Thanks a lot, Abraham.
Thanks for having me on the show.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The Iranian nuclear deal has raised the specter of Iran becoming a nuclear state. Now, nuclear war is something that's very unreal to most people. It's been a long time since anyone suffered the effects of a nuclear bomb being detonated. I remember as a kid, I grew up toward the end of the Cold War. Nuclear war with Russia was on a lot of people's minds. In 1983, the movie The Day After caused quite a stir in school. We were talking about the possibility of a bomb going off. We even had bomb drills. Today, though, the prospect of a bomb doesn't seem very real to many people. Trumpet writer Brad McDonald has written an article discussing the reality of nuclear war by looking at those who experienced its horrors firsthand, the people who went through the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II. I have Mr. McDonald here with me via Skype from our office in the UK. How are you doing, Brad?
Doing well, thank you.
So this book, can you tell us about this book that gives a firsthand account from the people who experienced this?
Right. The title of the book is Hiroshima, and some of the older people in the audience may have heard of it. They probably have heard of it. It was written by John Hershey. It was a bestseller. Millions of copies have been distributed around the world in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And it was required reading for a lot of children in the 60s, 70s, 80s. It sounds like, it was required reading for you too, even in 1981, 1982.
I never read the book. I remember it being a big deal. This was in the middle of the Cold War, and it was mutually assured destruction between the United States and Russia. And that television movie, it was a huge sensation in the United States, and it was the topic of a lot of discussion even in elementary schools at that time.
Right, right. Well, the story is, in May 1946, the New Yorker magazine sent John Hershey. I think he'd written one book by then. He was a regular journalist for the New Yorker. They sent John to Japan, and they wanted him to interview survivors of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. They wanted him to visit those two cities, and they wanted him to get a firsthand look at the destructiveness of a nuclear bomb. This was the first time in history that something of something like this had been had occurred. So a lot of people had maybe seen a few images. There had been some newspaper articles, but the New Yorker sent John over there with the goal of making it real for the audience. So he went over there. He was over there for a month or two. He conducted hundreds of interviews with survivors. And the book Hiroshima tells the story of six individuals who were in Hiroshima when little boy was dropped. I think it was August 6th, 1945. And the little boy was the name of the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. So John goes through and he tells the story of these six individuals. One of them was an office clerk, one was a doctor, one was a priest. And he just relays the hours and even the days after Hiroshima was dropped on after little boy was dropped on Hiroshima.
So you get an idea of the level of destruction, say, close to the detonation site.
Right.
And then obviously the effects are different as it goes out. The people who survived this obviously were some distance away enough that they were able to survive the initial blast. But then the effects that they personally experienced were quite severe from the after effects.
Right. I think 65,000 people were killed instantly in the zone right around the impact zone. 100,000 were injured. Hiroshima was a city of 250,000, and pretty much the entire city was destroyed. The people who survived, they were all at least 1,000 to 1,500 to 2,000 meters from the impact point. And but they all felt the effects, obviously. They were thrown across the room. They were buried in rubble. They experienced terrible, terrible burns. They witnessed friends and family be killed. And they experienced it very intimately. And like I said, they were 1,000 or 1,500 meters away from where it actually landed.
So what were the effects, say, over in the initial hours after the blast?
Well, at first there was just shock and silence. No one had a clue what had just happened. Each of these individuals that Hershey interviewed recalled seeing a blinding light, and then just a few seconds later, a massive explosion. They were all thrown against a wall, thrown against a rock. They were all dislodged, and then for a few minutes after, there was just shock and disbelief. Hershey recounts how one or two of them kind of just walked around, and a lot of people were expecting that a bomb had been dropped locally. They expected to see a few houses blown up on their street. But these people walked to the top of the hill and they just looked around. And as far as the eye could see, houses were just completely flattened. There was smoke. There was this miasma, as Hershey put it, which is just miasma. I think it means there was a putrid stench, kind of like a chemical smell in the air. And then over the next few minutes and over the next hour or two or three, what happened is anyone, those who were closest to the detonation or to the impact where the bomb impacted and survived, those people started making their way out. Obviously, they were running away from where the explosion occurred. And these six survivors helped those people. And they talk about just some horrible images of, people with their eye sockets or their eyes melted and the fluid running down their cheeks. People with skin that had peeled from their body. One of the individuals talked about how he was trying to lift, or he was trying to pull someone into a boat that he was on, and the skin on their arm just kind of peeled off in his hands. There really is just, it's scenes that are hard for us to imagine. And you know, if any of us can imagine them, usually it's with the help of a movie or special effects in, you know, some Hollywood film. But this was real. This really happened, and it happened to thousands and thousands of people.
It does seem like the people, the New Yorker sending this journalist over there, recording these and ensuring that these images were preserved and spread, and the people who wanted to introduce this into school curricula, that type of thing, they were trying to make something that is difficult for the mind to grasp more real to us, to understand the effects, to understand just how devastating something like this can be. You can look at in a history book and you can see statistics. And it seems to me like the same kind of failure to grasp reality kind of surrounds this whole negotiation and deal that has been going on with Iran. The specter of nuclear war just is not real to us, and it is something that's worth setting your imagination on.
Right. The term nuclear war, or the thought of a nuclear bomb exploding, you know, it's addressed in a movie. We have a James Bond detonating a nuclear weapon and saving the day, or it's just a political talking point. It's a political issue. It's more of an intellectual exercise. I can't think of too many people, at least recently, who have really sat down and just talked about, okay, what does a nuclear explosion look like? What does it feel like? What does it smell like? I can't think of, you know, too many news organizations approaching the subject of nuclear warfare from that perspective.
No, it's not something we want to think about.
Right. It's unpleasant to think about. And, you know, human nature doesn't like to think about unpleasant things or things that make it feel uncomfortable or that might be emotionally disturbing. So we don't do it. But that doesn't mean it's not a reality.
It seems to me like what you're describing, that aspect of human nature that wants to put these kinds of thoughts out of mind, that's kind of underpinning a lot of what's happening politically right now with respect to Iran. It's almost like the unwillingness to accept the idea that someone would actually use a weapon like this.
Right. And I think it gets back to the intellectual vanity of these guys sitting at the negotiating table with Iran. They think that they're smart enough to prevent this from ever happening. And it's not just the politicians, it's the media, and I think it's the mainstream public in general. As a society, and a particularly Western society, you know, there's a confidence. As a society, we think that we're so advanced morally, and we're so advanced in our basic human emotions that, well, you know, we're so advanced, we're so sophisticated, we're so enlightened in the 21st century that no one would think about dropping a nuclear weapon. They trust in their ability to reason with someone who wants to potentially drop a nuclear weapon, or they think that they can be talked out of it. They just overestimate their ability to solve the problem, or they think they can solve it with conversation, with reason, with negotiation, with compromise. And I think it just reveals a massive false sense of security, and at its core, a basic trust in the self.
You know, just the basic goodness of human beings. And they're backed up by a lot of people who are so caught up in distractions and other pursuits that they're not, they have no reason to think about those things until the day comes when something like this actually does blow up in our faces.
Right, right. Yeah, you look at the 21st century Western world, and it doesn't look like we're living in the Middle Ages. We're far less barbaric. You know, we're far less simple-minded. We're far less intolerant. This is what people are thinking. We're far less intolerant. Everything is pretty and shiny. And our leaders have PhDs, and they've been to university where they learn how to negotiate and form compromises. We're beyond detonating nuclear weapons. That's so 20th century.
The interesting thing is just to contrast everything that you're describing with, say, the images that are coming out of the Middle East that were being provided by the Islamic State and just some of the realities of terrorist attacks that are going on throughout that region. And you see some of the barbarity that's taking place even just south of the United States border within Mexico.
Right.
You realize, you know, we're not so different from some of those more darker periods in human history. The difference is that the destructive potential of the weapons that are available is much, much greater.
Absolutely. The little boy was a 15 kiloton nuclear bomb. That's 0.015 megatons. It killed 60,000 people. It injured 100,000 people. It wiped out an entire city. Today, you know, we have about 20,000 nuclear bombs around the planet. Most of these bombs are significantly larger in size than Little Boy. Little Boy, as I mentioned, was 15 kiloton. Today's nuclear bombs are 15,000 to 20,000 kilotons. Some of them are 50,000 kilotons, which is more than 3,000 times more powerful than that bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima.
Unbelievable.
And as you alluded to, you know, not only do we have these weapons, 20,000 of them on the planet, but we have, let's say, we see the mental or the psychological requirements to start a nuclear war present on this earth. You know, the decision to start a nuclear war, it happens in someone's mind, and they're influenced by one, you know, they're influenced by fear. Or maybe they're influenced by uncertainty. Or maybe they're influenced by a desperate hatred for whomever they drop the bomb on. Maybe they're a religious fanatic and they believe it's their duty to start, you know, World War III. We see the psychological requirements for nuclear war.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, it's there. The motivation for great conflict or the motivation for nuclear war, it's there.
Gerald Fleury talks about this in this Key of David program that'll be airing this Friday. The fact that an Iranian nuke, a nuclear weapon in the hands of an Iranian leader, is much different than it is in the hands of any other nation that's ever possessed these weapons because of that religious zealotry aspect of it. There's an extremely unpredictable, like the whole concept of mutually assured destruction is founded on the fundamental desire to survive and to protect your people and those elements of civilization that have prevailed that would prevent someone from doing that. It doesn't work in this model doesn't work if you have someone at the helm who is actually seeking apocalypse.
Right, exactly. And then we can't forget that this world is influenced and led, you know, by a spiritual influence, by Satan the devil. And he loves conflict. He loves war. He has no hesitation inflicting suffering on mankind.
When you put the descriptions, say, from this journalist who recorded what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki immediately after World War II and hold it up against biblical prophecies of exactly what's going to happen in this world in the days just leading up to the second coming of Jesus Christ, you see a whole lot of overlap. You see a lot of alignment there.
Right. There are a number of prophecies. Isaiah has two or three prophecies. There's prophecies of nuclear war in Matthew 24. The book of Revelation has imagery which implies nuclear destruction. I haven't got it in front of me, but there's a prophecy in Isaiah that talks about in the end time, when the conflict comes in the end time, you know, that weapons will be used, warfare will be used, that will result in people's eyeballs melting in their sockets, just like Hershey recalls in his book. A prophecy in Joel talks about blinding flashes of light across the earth. Again, Hershey recalls that in his book. That's what these people saw. Immediate or as soon as the bomb was dropped. And you know, there are just a number of prophecies that very clearly the way the prophecy is described and the devastation that is experienced, it can only come about as a result of nuclear explosions.
Right. You don't look at conventional weapons creating
right.
these kinds of conditions.
Exactly.
Yeah, amazing. It's really, really important subject to try to wrap our minds around, and we know that it's going to become a reality very soon, and you can see conditions in the world today leading us right down the primrose path to that future, a repetition of history, only many times worse. Thank you, Mr. McDonald. The article is called Fire from the Sky by Brad McDonald. It's due to be in the coming edition of the Trumpet, the September issue of the print edition of the Trumpet News Magazine, and you can read it online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Brad.
You're welcome.
It's time for today's last word.
We had a recent segment about the importance of good posture, and I received this poem from one of our listeners that I thought I would share with you. It's a short little poem. We'll use this for today's last word. I've been told as I've grown older, too round has grown each shoulder. So being told this is true, I sought instruction on what to do. Firstly, put your back to the wall until the back of your head is also touching the wall. I did just what they said. Then walk away, still with your head held in that position. And unfortunately, I've not yet recovered from that not normal transition. Instead, my neck is very stiff, and it really hurts when I try to even turn my head sideways, so must look out of the corner of my eye. Then I found when, with my head down, and oh yes, a bent back, my chest was really caved in, so figured that surely is a bit slack. But continually hoisting up my chest and trying to keep it there, I, by a minute-by-minute exercise of poor posture, am made aware. When I sit at the computer or sit down at the piano to play or digging in the garden, do I good posture display? And so, because of my trial and your talking this week on this subject of always maintaining good posture, this health rule we must not neglect. It is a tremendous achievement to be able to look forward to looking people straight in the eye. That is, if they have good posture too. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests, Andrew Miller, Abraham Blondeau, and Brad McDonald. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Lena Horne. It's not the load that breaks you down. It's the way you carry it. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.